Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Long before the COVID-19 pandemic, access to the internet had become part of the fabric of modern life. Of course, that access depended on where you lived and your ability to pay for it. It was a problem, but not one viewed as critical. We were wrong. The pandemic has shown us just how critical broadband access has become. With schools migrating instruction online, the chasm created by this so-called digital divide is gaping and alarming. Some say it is a national crisis. As many as 17 million students across the country are without internet access. In Charlotte, 45,000 homes are without access, mostly in communities of color. The result is de facto digital redlining, and the negative consequences could prove to be enormous, both for individuals and for society. Local organizations, all the way up to Congress, are working to address the gap, and we're going to hear about those efforts this hour. Pat Millen is founder and president of Eliminate the Digital Divide, E2D for short. That's a Charlotte-based nonprofit that's been working since 2013 on this problem and has closed the divide for 12,000 families. Pat, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Angela Seifer is executive director of the National Digital Inclusion Alliance. She's been working on this since 1997 at the national level. And when we told Pat Millen that Angela would be one of our guests, his response was, that's great. She knows more about this work than anybody in the country. So from Columbus, Ohio, ladies and gentlemen, Angela Seifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
You're welcome. And Sonia Gant is executive director of the Charlotte Mecklenburg Foundation, which works to generate investments to support CMS, and she joins us as well. Good morning. Good to see you again.
Good morning, Mike. Glad to be here.
So, Angela, let me start with you because you've been working on this, I think, the longest. You began in 1997, and in digital years, that's the Pleistocene era. Why were you even aware of this challenge back then?
When I was in grad school, I had a professor who decided to ask local nonprofits how it was the university could support them, and I was his grad assistant. And one of the top answers that came back was technology with their constituents. So they wanted their constituents to be able to use technology, and they wanted to be able to communicate with their constituents using technology. And that has led me down a path of the use of what back then we thought of more as just technology. We didn't think of it as the internet. When we were building computer labs back then, maybe one computer in the whole lab would have access to the internet. And we thought that was cool that we had one. So it wasn't as if the internet was the focus back then. It was, can you create your resume? Can you learn how to use the Word or the Office Suite, right? Use Word or Excel in order to get a job. That's more where the focus was then. Of course, the focus has changed massively since then. And now we think of it as the internet, and we think of it as essential to every day.
So back then it was access to hardware and digital literacy. And what we're talking about this morning is this digital divide created by the haves and have nots, the people who have and people who don't have access to the internet. But is the magnitude of the problem similar or worse today? In other words, if you only had one computer hooked up to the internet back then and you had to learn how to use Word and Excel, that's one thing. Today, everybody has to know all this and everybody has to have access.
The difference is you could survive without it. So try surviving today without it. Try not getting COVID without the internet today, right? Isn't it a tool that all of us are using to stay safe in our homes and do things digitally, like we're not all in Mike's office right now, right? That's a big change from what it would have been before. The necessity of it is much more prevalent. Mm-hmm. And it's also now there's a greater awareness that one needs the access to the internet, the device for the whatever your task is, your everyday tasks, and then also the digital literacy. And if we only address one or two of those and not all of them, we're failing miserably.
So, Pat, if I understand this correctly, your organization, Eliminate the Digital Divide, was founded after your then 12-year-old daughter asked how can kids in our school do their homework and projects successfully if some of their families are too poor to own digital technology. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And that was 9 years ago. And that's a question she could easily ask today as well.
Wow. And the second question that she asked you was, what are we going to do about it? Which I guess was the impetus for you to start doing something about it. How did all this begin? How did Eliminate the Digital Divide begin? And where has this journey taken you?
Well, at the time, I was intrigued by the question because I was sitting there going, I don't know how big the digital divide is. How pervasive is it? Is it everywhere? Is it just in certain pockets of population? And so just as a family, I was in the midst of another career, 24-year career. But as a family, we just sort of started studying it together and started talking to politicians, talking to educators, trying to figure out, all right, is this thing going to be something that is fixable? Because it felt fixable to me based on the fact that, well, you know, if somebody doesn't have a computer or the internet, maybe that's a $300 solution that could take care of that for a family. And if that's the case, we can raise that money. We can find those computers. And so we went to one elementary school and we found 54 families at one elementary school that didn't have any computers. And that was about $15,000. And I'm like, all right, we can raise that fairly quickly. But then the more we thought about it, we said, that's a good solution. A better solution would be to start doing this bigger and broader and wider. And so at the time we ended up going, we were asking lots of corporations, like, what do you do with your computers when you're done with them? And we happened to stumble into the best one, the local, I live in Davidson, just a couple of miles down the road from the headquarters of Lowe's. And I went to Lowe's and said, can you guys help us? And they came back and said, we can give you 500 laptops a year and they won't have anything on them. You'll have to find software and you'll have to figure out how to clean them up and get them ready to go. But if you can do that, you can distribute them. And so within about 3 months of even our beginning to investigate this, we were able to eliminate the digital divide for every school student in the town of Davidson and the town of Cornelius.
Wow.
And so we're like, okay, that's great. What do we do now? And about that time, we went into Charlotte and started talking to CMS. And they said, what you're doing up in the northern part of the county is great, but if you're really going to impress us, you need to come to Charlotte. And I said, give us the hardest thing we can do in Charlotte. And they said, we've got some Title I high schools that need a lot of computers. And that's where we've been ever since.
So, Sonia, you're with the CMS Foundation. And I don't know that people know what that is, but you're not really part of CMS, although their logo kind of appears on your webpage. Explain the relationship between the two organizations.
I think it helps to think of us, I always metaphorically use the term of a bridge. So we do work with Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. We're the 501c3 independent, basically the fundraising arm of the district. That's our entire purpose, is to work with CMS leaders and figure out where do you strategically need philanthropic support. And then I go out into the community and share the story of those needs and try to find folks who want to help us reach the goal together.
So, let's work
directly alongside CMS. I'll never be working on a project that school leaders haven't said, this is what we need. And I think if you think about the university model, I'm a proud Tar Heel graduate. And even though UNC gets public dollars, my parents' tuition money, they also have a development office that works directly with university leaders to go out and find support for programs. So that's essentially what we're doing for our public schools in Mecklenburg County.
So as I said at the very beginning, access to the internet was a problem long before the COVID-19 pandemic. But from CMS's point of view, Sonia, and from school systems around the country's points of view, what has this education online only paradigm done to the urgency of all of this?
You know, I think teachers, and Angela touched on it, teachers have known this has been an issue for a while. And Franny, Pat's daughter, was referring to that homework gap. They've known that we assign students work that requires them to be able to get on the internet. And fortunately, students have had to be resourceful. They could go to libraries. Sometimes they were going to community centers or restaurants. But what COVID did is really take it up a notch, because now not only are you having problems doing your homework, But when instruction is taken online, now that means you're not even able to access the back and forth that we want you to have with your teacher without having it. So I think it amplified it 10 times over, especially when you consider in March when school buildings closed, libraries were also closed, community centers were closed, other places that students might go to access the internet, they were all closed as well. So it's increased, I think, our knowledge of it.
Angela.
In the pre-COVID era, it was considered to be okay that the kids would need to go to the library or to a McDonald's to do their homework. It was not okay then, right? What COVID did is exposed that that's not okay. That we can't say, and this was really killing me when the Band-Aid solution at the beginning of COVID was, let's put Wi-Fi in parking lots. Do not tell me that that child should do their homework in the parking lot.
Well, there was a picture on the news the other night of these two young kids, they were probably 8 years old, sitting with their legs crossed with their laptops open on a sidewalk, and an employee of a fast food restaurant was leaning over into them because they were sitting outside the fast food restaurant so that they could use that restaurant's Wi-Fi. In the United States of America, that seems to me to be absolutely unequivocally unacceptable.
It is a huge failure.
It's not at all rare, right.
And so where did the failure come from? I think it's an important question.
So the question here to me is obviously initially getting the equipment to people, getting the software on that equipment was a challenge, but an affordable one, because whereas computers used to cost $5,000, you can go to Best Buy now and buy a brand new one for $300, and you can buy a used one for practically nothing, and you've been able to, help from Lowe's picking up the tab on, I think, what, two-thirds of it, have been able to raise a lot of money and spend it very wisely. How do you then get the internet access? Because without that, these are just entities unto themselves. Nobody loads on the Microsoft Encyclopedia anymore. You have to have access to the internet. So, Angela, that's the big challenge, right?
It is a huge challenge, but
why?
I should also
why is it such a big challenge? Why?
Okay, so it's a big challenge because in the United States, broadband purchasing broadband service for your home is a commodity. It's not a utility. It's very lightly regulated. There's no price controls, and so even though the infrastructure exists for multiple providers in the Charlotte area, it is expensive. And we don't have the digital skills sometimes to be able to use it. So why would you purchase something expensive that you're not sure is really even a, you know, you're not sure how to make the most out of it? So we have to fix that cost issue. Unless we think that the internet service providers are going to all be like, sure, regulate us. No, that's not going to happen. Then our other alternative is finding more sources of broadband locally so that there's more competition to drive down the price, and that there needs to be a subsidy. Somebody needs to be paying for broadband internet. We do need to drive down the price, but that only gets us at affordable for middle-income folks. It doesn't get us to affordable for low-income folks. That's where the subsidy becomes essential. But can I add to, like, you all are lucky that you have E2D. You know how many areas have nothing like E2D? And the only reason E2D exists is because of Pat and Franny, right? Like, that's insane. That other areas have nothing in terms of how do we get these low-cost devices.
Speaking of E2D, Pat, one of the things that you've been successful in doing is getting equipment through the help of a partner, a corporate partner, and I'm going to ask when we come back from the break what success, if any, you've had with a corporate partner in providing the internet part of this, but that has to wait till after this. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Sonia Gant is with us, Executive Director of the CMS Foundation. They raise money for the school system. Angela Seifer is Executive Director of the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, which has been in existence for quite a while now. And Pat Millen, Founder and President of Eliminate the Digital Divide. So, Pat, we were talking earlier in the program about your organization successfully partnering with Lowe's to get about 500 computers a year. And I think Lowe's contributes 2/3 of what your fundraising has been able to come up with in terms of the value of what you're doing. What about internet access providers? We have AT&T, we have Spectrum, we've got the various digital mobile phone companies, etc. Have you had any success? Have you approached any of these companies to encourage them to be generous corporate partners and provide access to the internet to people who don't have that access, particularly if they have a young person in school?
So we certainly know all of them individually, locally, and work with them, and recognizing that a company the size of Spectrum, Charter, or AT&T, decisions are not being rendered locally for sure. In fact, right, that's a big part of what Angela's job is to be advocating at the national level there. But what is important to realize is that each one of the providers has some sort of a low-cost plan, but they don't necessarily make it easy to get it. Okay, the plans are very, very different. You have to jump through different hoops to be able to get that done. What we try to do is work with every family that gets a computer to make them aware of what are the low-cost possibilities where you are. And just as a quick thing, Lowe's actually gave us 3,500 computers last year alone.
Okay.
They've
wow.
ramped that up a lot. But a great example is Spectrum here in Charlotte. We just got our fourth consecutive grant for them where we provide hotspots to homeless families within the CMS, what they call McKinney-Vento homeless families. Spectrum provides these hotspots and a full subsidy for them. And it's not even their product. It's one of their competitors' products because they don't have a hotspot. And yet 1,000 kids are now online because of Spectrum buying another company's hotspots. It's pretty remarkable.
So it's good to know that there are corporate people who feel some sort of responsibility to the community and the corporate level there. But you've also said, Pat, that there are internet companies in Charlotte that are not particularly motivated to drive down certain streets and bring last mile access to every neighborhood, and that's a problem. I'm sure all of that's based on a cost-benefit analysis, and it is not inexpensive to run fiber optic cable or to do whatever you have to do to get internet to every nook and cranny of Mecklenburg County and around the country. But for years, we paid, and I probably still do, on our electric bills, a fee for rural electrification. And on my phone bill for years, I know that I paid for access to low-income people to have a telephone in their home. Is it time to levy? I hate to advocate for this because nobody wants to pay more money for anything, particularly internet. But is it time to advocate for some sort of a fee to be attached to internet bills to pay for this last mile of coverage?
I think it is. And I'll pass it to you, Angela, because you know about it at the national level. I think it definitely is. And I don't know if you even necessarily need to make it a requirement. I think you could have it be an opt-in situation potentially and raise a lot of money. Again, with that, though, you have to promote the fact that this is a very dire problem that needs a corporate community chest of database or of bandwidth that we can work with. I think this is a great way to do it. It's how back in 1918, there was like 18% of the households had telephones in them. But by the beginning of World War II, 70% of cities. Yeah. Homes had them. We've got to do that level of escalation right now.
Angela, we're a capitalist and not a socialist country, and there's a big argument right now about all of that in our political sphere. And you do have to protect against whatever comes your way as somebody who needs this for their children not being abused. It's not, if this is coming to you free of charge, it's because your kids need access to the internet, not because you just bought a 4K TV and you need high-speed access to feed the stream. So how do you fix that problem? How do you determine who needs this, who deserves this?
So I don't think you do actually fix that problem. I think if they want to watch Netflix, it's not taking away. If you're already covering the cost of the internet for another purpose, because you want it there for the kids, for the kids' education. You want it there for the parents too. And this is another soapbox I get on. Kids don't live alone. So we cannot only worry about the access for the kids. We need to make sure that the adults in their lives have it. We think of all the ways that we all use it, that it makes our lives easier. I don't go into my bank anymore, right? All of the ways that I'm able to communicate with my family, with my job, applying for jobs, learning new skills, learning how to fix my toilet, right? All of those things I'm doing because I'm fortunate enough to have the internet in my home. Do right. I also watch Netflix? Yes. But is that taking away from, is that hurting anything? No, not at all, because you're already covering the cost of the service itself. So really focusing in on the internet needs to be there. How do we get it there? And it is a huge challenge in the United States because the internet service providers control so much. So watching our policies, who can do what, who can bring in additional competition to an area. In Charlotte, you all, your biggest providers are AT&T and Charter Spectrum. Both of them have low-cost discount offers that individual families can sign up for. And so that's a huge value. I encourage, you know, anyone who's eligible to go sign up for those low-cost offers. Those two low-cost offers are not what those two companies are making available via what's being called direct payer agreements. So direct payer agreements are the school system or even E2D or foundations, whoever wants to do it could, you know, in other places can go in and say, okay, I want to pay for X number of accounts. You know, I'm going to write you one check. And then the school system or whoever decides who it is going to get those accounts. With AT&T, their only offer, they want it to be wireless. So their discount wireline offer, can't negotiate that for a direct payer agreement. With Spectrum, for their discount offer for families who are eligible, $18 a month plus taxes takes you a little over $20 a month. Direct payer, $30 a month. Costs you more for the direct payer agreement.
You know, the $30 a month, $20 a month doesn't sound like all that much, but when you consider that some young people in the school system can't afford lunch, that's a lot of money. $20 and $30 a month is a lot of money and unaffordable. It's out of the reach of the parents' ability to pay. So, Sonia, is the CMS Foundation involved in some of these block purchases of internet access, and then which they then distribute to clients themselves?
We most certainly are involved. Before I answer that question, I want to go back to Pat's discussion of what he was able to do in North Mecklenburg County with getting computers in those schools, because I think it's important that we really appreciate that right now, because of strategic investments made by Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools to make sure that every student in school has a device that's dedicated to them, a laptop, that's helped us have half the puzzle that a lot of school districts across the country don't have. And what I mean by that is when the school doors closed, for the first time, they sent home laptops with students in 4th through 12th grade. Before that time, those laptops could only be used in the school building. So Pat's work, what that was about, is getting computers into homes. There's so many of us, I think, who can't imagine our houses without a computer or without the internet. So Mecklenburg County, CMS was in a great position to send those devices home. But that's when the foundation was brought in, because CMS leaders said to us, listen, we're sending the devices home, but we know they're not as useful in homes that don't have internet access. So in the spring, the CMS Foundation, thanks to three very generous partners, was able to raise $1 million to purchase 6,000 mobile hotspots that would provide 6 months of internet access. We began distributing them and distributed about 3,000 in the spring. We saved 3,000 for the beginning of this school year. Pat mentioned McKinney Vento, some of our students who don't have stable housing, they were prioritized. We also went into our middle schools and elementary schools because our high schools were being covered under a different project. And there are about, we now know 5,000 of those devices that were active. But in all those numbers, I think what I want us to remember, and Angela said it, you know, very well, are we okay with students being without? I think about my own children, and they were still doing homework at 10 and 11 o'clock at night in the safety of their own home, because for us, we were able to afford the internet, and really we see it as a basic need here, not as a luxury. And so when we talk about, one thing Angela said that I think we have to appreciate when you talk about who's using it, when you provide internet access, I think you are really providing a way for everybody in the house to be engaged. Yes, it's about students being engaged in classwork, but I don't think any of us, you can't fill out a job application right now without being able to get online and use a computer. So I just didn't want us to lose the fact that, remember, the CMS students who have devices are going to turn them back in. Pat's work is about making sure that even when they're not a CMS student, they have support and have a device to use.
Pat.
So I think that the cities right now that are addressing this across the country sort of the most creatively are the ones that are coming to acknowledge that providing the internet, you know, calling it a subsidy to some people rubs people the wrong way or to appear to be taxed. But I want, one really important way to look at this, Mike, is that from an economic driven standpoint, you know, a study came out a few years ago that said that every kid that drops out of high school is going to have a $300,000 sort of drain on society in terms of societal costs, lack of taxes paid due to lack of productivity. So if CMS graduates 1% more of kids per year, that's $36 million over the course of those kids' lives. So one of the, and not to mention the fact that in Charlotte, North Carolina alone, during coronavirus, there are 40,000 unfilled IT jobs, entry-level tech jobs. So these are jobs that need to be filling. These are kids that need to be educated. These are kids that are, in many cases, going to be qualified to do these entry-level jobs. We have organizations all through Charlotte, like Lake Norman and Ballantyne IT Professionals, Aparo, CATC. If we take the time now to make the investment in these kids and get them to become 21st century digital citizens, we're going to be saving a lot of money that we're going to have to pay down the road anyway.
So is the cost of making sure that young people have access to computers and to the internet less to society as a whole over time than it would be if we just let them languish? Is that what you're saying?
So everyone's looking at it as what happens if we let them languish? How bad is it going to be? How much are they going to lose over time? Monroe Richardson and Reed Charlotte could tell you that a second grader losing 3 months of school this spring is like losing an entire year to a high school student. But we should stop worrying about who's going to languish, and we need to start looking at it the other way and saying, how are we going to make these kids prosper?
So when we were talking about hotspots a minute ago, and we should probably define that at some point in this conversation, because not everybody listening understands what that is. But let's just say for the sake of argument that CMS has CMS Foundation has sent out these thousands of hotspots. CMS opened up drive-through Wi-Fi locations, which are essentially hotspots outside of five schools this year. Now, the system is sending Wi-Fi hubs installed on school buses to other areas of the county. And Pat, you've said that this is a big deal because the state's been involved in doing this too, and that's a big deal, and it's what we ought to be doing. But what ought we be doing if we wanted to solve this on a permanent basis?
So can I jump in on part
sure.
of that, Mike, before Pat goes? I want to share that the extension of Wi-Fi beyond five school buildings and the piloting of two school buses in two areas are, as Angela said earlier, kind of a temporary solution. The CMS Foundation is now working to fill the gap. We have an estimated 16,000 students who are in need of these hotspots. And you're right, I have learned in many discussions, lots of us have not had to use a hotspot. It's a, you know, it's about the size of a phone, a little bit smaller. The ones we're providing already have the service put on it. And then our work is about, CMS has made an investment of $1 million. I told you, we work side by side. They are using state coronavirus relief funds that can be used for the purchase of devices only. And so my job is to now raise the money to make sure we can pay the service bill. And I've shared with a lot of people, it's like when you buy a phone and then you have to pay the phone bill each month.
Right.
The reason I wanted to jump in on the schools and the buses, because quite a few people have said to me, well, let's just put a bunch of buses out in communities and that should take care of the problem. I want people to understand you have to be within 150 feet of these buses in order to get the service. And I think earlier this week, it was like 95 degrees. So I want you to think about a child having the burden of getting there or somebody getting them there, hopefully sitting in an air-conditioned car while you are taking part in your back and forth learning with your teacher, what we call synchronous learning. So it's our Band-Aid until we get these hotspots in-house. The investment of CMS has allowed this purchase to move forward. So we are within weeks of being able to distribute to those students who are in need. But when we talk about buses, I have found many people think that is the end solution. And it isn't. And even when I talk with city officials who've been very interested in our work, we talk about public Wi-Fi. One of the messages that was really drilled into me as I talked with city officials who are trying to design better public Wi-Fi is that there are no guaranteed speeds with public Wi-Fi. And I hope we can all appreciate that while I might be able to search the internet on my phone, the data and speed that's required to be involved in classroom learning is requires a certain amount of speed. And I think all of us have experienced being kicked off a Zoom call or things slowing down and freezing. It's not just about getting on the internet, it's about having adequate speed and data.
Wow. There are about 45,000 households in Charlotte without internet access, despite these hotspots that have been put in certain places. This is happening not just in Charlotte, though, Angela. It's happening around the country. So when you're talking about, I think it was 17 million people without access to the internet, what does that mean? Does that mean we got 17 million kids sitting there at home, out of school, with no access to it? Is that what it means in 10 seconds or less?
That's exactly what it means, that they are not learning, and the families, the adults that they live with, can't do what they need to do.
We'll come back and follow up on that in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here talking about the digital divide and the impact it's having on children and on society at large now and in the future with Sonia Gant, Executive Director of the CMS Foundation, Pat Millen, Founder and President of Eliminate the Digital Divide, and Angela Seifer, Executive Director of the National Digital Inclusion Alliance. The White House put out a report, Angela, in 2013, during the Obama administration, alerting the country to a coming crisis of broadband inequity. Is this another instance, and we see a lot of this in government, of studies being conducted, reports being issued, and then it just sits on a shelf, it completely ignored?
The report itself may have been sitting on a shelf, but local communities were using the information in that to get work done, right? Pat has probably referenced items inside that report when he was applying for grants. That's how the solutions are happening right now, but that's not the big solutions we need. As mentioned, how many places don't have an E2D? Way too many. So what are those big solutions? And I know lots of folks don't want to talk federal funding, but this is indeed a crisis. It's a crisis that is being exacerbated by the current economic and health crisis that we have right now, the digital crisis. And if we don't deal with it in a big way, we are going to experience the ramifications from that forever.
So what we have is this, from what I'm hearing from you folks, is that we have this patchwork quilt of solutions being done on local levels across the country when the problem is nationwide. 17 million children have no access to the internet at a time when not only in normal times they would use it to do their homework, and just to be part of society at large, but they will also now have to go to class that way. So this is a major, major, major problem. And according to the former head of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, it would cost about $80 billion, that's B with a B, $80 billion to create broadband for everyone. In the scheme of things and the kind of money we've been spending recently, $80 billion is pocket change, isn't it?
But this is where everybody's going to get a headache when I say this. He was only talking about making sure that the infrastructure is available. The cost is actually higher than that.
Okay.
Right. That $80 billion that Wheeler was discussing didn't even get to the fact that folks can't afford it in some places where the infrastructure already exists. He's saying we need to make sure the infrastructure is there. And then tack on to that, that we need to make sure that digital literacy training is constantly available.
So what is the big solution? I mean, we have all this patchwork quilt and it seems to be multi-layered, the problem. So what is the solution?
It has to be national. And we do need all the players. As already mentioned, we need the corporate involvement. And we're seeing that at the local level, which is so exciting. We're seeing the foundations, right? The fact that Sonia is so knowledgeable about all this, that's awesome, right? So we've definitely made all these great gains during this terrible pandemic. We can use all of that, plus get some federal support to create the big solutions. It's not like a simple one-liner that's the big solution. It's going to be everything that we've already discussed. It's the devices and the connectivity and the digital literacy. And it's, as Pat mentioned, it's not just making sure everybody can use email, but how do we then get the folks who want to keep going? And then that changes their lives in terms of the potential careers that they can end up in. It's this huge kind of, let's look at it in a big way. And we are all about innovation in this country. So let's do it.
So who has to do it? Is it the government's job to do it? Is it internet service providers' jobs to do it? Is it local school systems' jobs to do it? Is it organizations like CMS Foundation to do it? Whose job is it?
It is all of them, Mike.
I was going to say all of the above. What people have to realize is, we are so fortunate in Charlotte, North Carolina, to have a corporate base that we have that makes things happen. So, you know, we're out raising money for the CMS Foundation right now to help get hotspots raised. But we also have tremendous numbers of corporate support. There are other cities throughout the country that frankly just don't have that. But the bottom line is, if we look at this as a national-based issue that is a bare minimum, What's good that's coming out of COVID is that we're never going to be able to ignore this issue again, okay? It has put a light on it that makes it impossible to ignore. There were people that just didn't even know there was this level of a digital divide. And then there were people that were utterly indifferent to it, Mike. No longer can that possibly be the case. And so if there's anything positive that's going to come out of this, is I don't think anything short of a national level solution is going to be deemed sufficient going forward.
So we have a short attention span in this country. I'm going to come to you, Sonia, but we have a short attention span in this country. And right now, you're absolutely right. It's impossible to ignore the digital divide right now. And I think also that the pandemic has made a lot of people not only aware of it, but even if they were aware of it, they didn't understand it. But now they do understand it because they can see it right in front of them. That's helped. I would think, Sonia, it's helping you raise money, too, because people understand the problem.
It is. It's personal for us, because a lot of people are saying, I wouldn't be able to work from home without internet access. And the thought that there is a child in my community that can't contact their classroom teacher because of it is personal. Lots of people have shared that with me as they call to find out about our campaign, which, by the way, is called Connect for Tech. And what we're asking the community for, to close the connectivity gap with these 16,000 devices and to pay for monthly service, is about a $4 million deal. CMS has already taken care of a million of it. They bought the devices. Today, I can tell you we've raised about $818,000. That represents some companies in our communities, but it also represents a lot of individuals who said, hey, I can give you 50. We know that it takes about $200 for us to provide the service for 12 months. But I think this resonates, Mike, because it is personal. And so even when COVID is over 2 years from now, folks know what the digital divide is, and they know without it in their homes, many wouldn't have been able to continue working. And it is a luxury to be able to work from your home and not really have your life disrupted in the way that so many people who don't have that luxury in a job are struggling. And I think we also have to appreciate, I know Pat, I've heard him talk about it a lot, is poverty is very real. And when you have to make a decision about whether or not you're going to buy food, pay rent, and whether or not you're going to pay an internet bill, sometimes that's the first bill to go.
Sure. According to the Pew Research Center, it isn't just attending online classes during this pandemic that is the challenge. A majority of eighth grade students in the country, even in normal times, are using the internet in order to do their homework. That homework gap, which is what this is more pronounced for Black, Hispanic, and lower-income households. And again, this is in normal times. We live in the richest country in the world, and that seems unconscionable to me. And it's most certainly widening another thing that this pandemic is revealing, and that is the social and economic divide at large in society, and how that impacts our social welfare as a country, as a people. All of us together, collectively. Do you think most citizens, most politicians, most policymakers, educators grasp the implications of the digital divide for society at large, Angela?
No, I don't, Mike. And the way that you can see that is the focus on the school kids. Like, because if we understood the broader implication, we wouldn't just be talking about children. We would be talking about all of our members of society and how it exacerbates existing inequities, right? So if you already were undereducated and you don't have access to the internet, good luck trying to educate yourself, because that's how lots of folks do it now. But also the point Pat was getting at earlier of, you know, the idea of when everybody has something like electricity, when everybody has that thing, then it changes how we all live. It changes society. And when certain segments of the population don't have that thing, it not only draws them down, it draws all of us down.
Is that, Pat, as you go around the country or go around the county, is that something that people are beginning to have a better understanding of? And given the fact that we have the social justice movement in our streets right now and have for months, and we have this access to healthcare problem, which we've had long before COVID-19, and we have we know that poor people, the frontline workers, the quote necessary workers, are the ones being exposed to this virus, and they are also the poorest, and they are also part of the digital divide. Is this coming? Is this coagulating in people's minds as a problem that really is all together? This is all intertwined.
Yeah, I wish it was coming together like a very simple cookie recipe that you could make off the internet. But the truth of the matter is. Everything's being cobbled together sort of one element at a time. So back in April, relatively early into this, we got a call from Atrium Health saying, hey, we've got a dozen young women who are at home quarantining with their new preemie babies, and they need to be talking to their NICU nurse every single day, multiple times. Can you help them get a computer? We're talking to Sheriff McFadden and Keith Cradle at the juvenile detention center in the north part of the county. And they're like, we're sending kids home. We can't send them home to the exact same thing. We need to help them find a new way to be successful. And without a computer, they realize that's not possible. So there is the schools. That's the obvious one. I've got a 10th grader downstairs right now who's in class and has been for a couple of hours. But there, as Angela said, it's school, but it's also the parents at home that have to get jobs, that have to do online banking so that they're not only getting 65 cents on the dollar at the check cashing store. The ramifications of this are universal for people that live below the poverty line. And we know that 54% of CMS's kids qualify for free or reduced lunch. We know that that's a huge group. But we have to persist beyond that and make sure that the parents can get jobs, the kids can do their work. Later on, I think it'd be perfectly fine to have everybody, when they're done with their work and their jobs, could go watch Netflix, but that's later.
So I have referred to this, Angela, as a patchwork quilt. You have referred to it as well-intentioned, absolutely necessary band-aids, our approach to fixing this problem. But you've also said that some areas of the country have found long-term solutions. What parts of the country have done this, and what are those solutions?
So the one that NDIA is paying really close attention to is Chicago. They formed a four-year plan, so clearly did not view this as just an emergency situation. They gathered money from all the different segments, right? They have CARES Act and from the school district and from foundations and corporate donors. Like, they got all the different folks involved, and they're addressing all the different pieces of it. They're addressing the devices, the connectivity, and the support. So they're putting money into organizations like E2D and others that are community-based but didn't have any technical expertise, but knew that knew their constituents, knew the folks that they had already were serving in another capacity, and giving them financial support to do that one-on-one, hand-holding. Because really, if someone says, hey, free internet, doesn't that sound kind of sleazy? Does it sound legit? It doesn't really sound legit, right? So unless that's coming from someone that others trust, you don't necessarily trust it. And one of the benefits that they have in Chicago is they have Comcast that offers these direct payer agreements for $10 a month, $120 for the year. Compare that to what Sonia just said, about $200 for the year. So all around the country, this is the patchwork part that is messed up. You all have to pay that much? And Chicago only is 120.
Is there a reason beyond corporate greed or the bottom line? Is it because in Chicago, it's easier to wire a dense city with internet than it is to wire a far-flung city with suburbs and places like that? Is that part of the
equation? No, because Comcast's doing that wherever they have service. Okay. And they're not in more dense places than the other providers. That's just a choice that they've made to do it that way. And I would say some encouragement to the other providers to do something similar is absolutely necessary. If we keep saying, okay, we'll pay the higher price over here because we can't get that deal, then we're letting them get away with it.
So we have the problem of hardware, and so, which has been solved to a great degree by both of your organizations, Pat and Sonia. Then we have the problem of access to the internet, which is still an ongoing problem. And we have a problem of digital literacy. You can have the box and you can have the wire, but if you don't know how to use it, it's of little use to you. How big of a problem is that in this equation? Very quickly, Sonia.
Well, I would say this. So we also know that when we put our user instructions on the CMS website, they are there in English and Spanish. For the new ones that are coming in, we're working with school personnel to be able to explain to each parent how to do this. I will say that digital literacy, I think the students who graduate are definitely much more digitally literate than I was coming out, because they have been using these devices. But I agree, in the community, and I know that Pat's organization has hosted classes in our jails and community centers. I know the YMCA has hosted several, and that's key. And it's a key piece of it. It certainly is. And the district is doing its part by providing the instructions and helping school personnel be able to walk parents through it.
We are almost out of time, and so we don't really have time to talk about digital redlining, but that is essentially what's happening here. It's if you are not able to supply an internet connection to the poorest among us, that's essentially what's similar to what happened with the redlining of real estate. It's locking people out of a better life. Sonia, I know you want to plug your organization, CMS Foundation, so do it now.
Yes, cms-foundation.org/relief. You can learn more about this effort. I hope you'll be compelled to contribute. We're going to reach our goal, and it's been community support. Thank you, Pat.
Sonia Gant, Executive Director of the CMS Foundation, Pat Millen, Founder President of Eliminate the Digital Divide, E2D, and Angela Seifer, Executive Director of the National Digital Inclusion Alliance. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.